This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. On the program today, how we measure this economy, what the labor market is telling us right now about this economy, and the civil rights movement and this economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday today, the 23rd day of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There is, within the Department of Commerce, an office called the Bureau of Economic Analysis that is responsible, among a whole lot of other things, for figuring out the total value of all the goods and services produced in this economy, the gross domestic product, GDP. We talk about it a lot because knowing how much or sometimes even whether the economy is growing is important to know. And the BEA, again, the Bureau of Economic Analysis, makes its GDP estimates for the year and for each quarter of the year, annualized, of course, and then it revises those estimates twice. Today, the Bureau announced its first revision of fourth quarter GDP for last year, 2.7% economic growth, annualized, of course, down from its first guess of 2.9%. But why? Why the drop? And why the revisions? Marketplace's Lily Jamali gets us going.
That revision of 0.2% for what's called headline GDP isn't huge, but EY chief economist Gregory Dacco says the components that make up GDP made some big moves in this first update.
Consumer spending was revised down from an elevated reading to a much lower reading by 0.7 percentage points.
That's notable because about two-thirds of GDP comes from consumer spending.
That was partially offset by upward revisions, which were actually quite significant for business investment.
All those changes reflect how the Bureau of Economic Analysis estimates GDP. The BEA, as it's known, maintains a 454-page handbook of data points that go into the final number, says Austin Clements of the Washington Center for Equitable Growth.
You have things like casino gambling. They have a deal with the National Indian Gaming Commission where they report some of their receipts to BEA.
Others include college sports sales data from the NCAA and information about paid streaming subscriptions from the Recording Industry Association of America. With inputs coming from so many sources,
a lot of it is coming to you in different kinds of formats or varying degrees of quality.
One single survey might come back from, say, retailers over the course of months, says Jonathan Pingle, chief U.S. economist at UBS.
For that first month, there's only a few thousand respondents to that survey. A month later, they have over 10,000 respondents to that survey.
The BEA makes revisions to include that new information, says Moody's Analytics chief economist Mark Zandi. And he says GDP estimates, like so much of the data that economists look at, aren't precise.
It's not like you're reading an X-ray of the economy. It's like you're reading an impressionist painting of the economy.
The revision released today may eventually get updated 8 or 9 more times, each version getting a little closer to the true picture. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
All right, so I'll tell you what, GDP is important. The labor market, as you're going to hear in a minute, is important. What really matters right now, though, is inflation, about which we will learn more tomorrow with the Federal Reserve's favorite measure. Say it with me now, because you've heard me say it a million times: personal consumption Expenditures, PCE. Wall Street Today traders kind of waiting and seeing. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The United States Department of Labor shared with us its weekly report on jobless claims this morning, specifically first-time claims for unemployment benefits, known as initial claims by some, down 3,000 from a week ago to 192,000. So there is that, nice and low. Continuing claims were down to 37,000 fewer people than a week earlier. Now, because these are weekly numbers, it's real easy to just let them go past you without really thinking about them. But there is a reason we bring them up right now. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains what they tell us about the labor market and what they don't.
When we talk about unemployment claims, like we are today, we talk about what they look like for the whole country. But every state has a different system, different rules, different payouts. And, says Catherine Ann Edwards, a labor economist and policy consultant at the RAND Corporation, it's a benefit with a regular expiration date.
And it absolutely expires. It has the most frequent recertification to say, I'm still unemployed, I'm still looking, I still don't have a job, and I need to claim this for weeks.
But not everyone who loses a job applies for unemployment insurance, much less keeps applying to maintain it.
If, for example, they have severance payments, they may not see the need to do this.
Audrey Guo teaches economics at Santa Clara University's Levy School of Business. Despite the fact the continuing claims numbers don't capture everyone out of work,
continuing claims kind of gives us a sense of how long unemployment spells last.
And these numbers are saying not that long. Gary Hoover is a professor of economics at Tulane University.
Everything that we're seeing is indicating that we have a really tight labor market, or else we would have seen claims stay persistent much longer, and we would have seen increases in initial jobless claims. Neither one of those are taking place.
Getting these numbers weekly helps economists and business journalists keep close tabs on these trends to see pretty quickly when things in the labor market change. But
I'm a little bit cynical about this, where I don't think we need to pay attention to it every week.
Div Bhagia teaches economics at California State University Fullerton.
But I think what helps is to look at it in the whole picture, you know, so like how has this been going for the last 2 months or last 3 months? And that gives us sort of an idea of where we're headed.
Which, of course, could completely change next week. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
It'll be a year tomorrow that Russia went to war in Ukraine. Not really, arguably at all, the biggest shock to the global economy all year. Metals, oil and gas, and food, it affected everything. Ukraine has for decades been known as the breadbasket of Europe. More recently, though, it's more like the breadbasket of the world, because grain from Ukraine and parts of Russia make its way all over into the Middle East and sub-Saharan Africa in particular. But that trade has suffered in the war, and that is making food insecurity worse in a lot of developing countries, including Egypt. Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports.
Every Saturday, Islam Sabri spends his morning selling bread at an upscale market in Cairo.
And I have multigrain. The multigrain is white flour, whole wheat flour, oats and lentils.
Sabri has been baking and selling artisanal bread out of his apartment for a decade.
Should I slice it?
No.
During the week, he delivers bread on his motorbike, and on Saturdays, he comes to this market. In the last year, it's been getting harder for him to make a living selling bread in Cairo.
Because of the economy problems and wars and stuff around the world, it's very, very hard to get flour.
Egypt is one of dozens of countries where it's gotten harder and more expensive to get wheat ever since Russia invaded Ukraine. In Cairo these days, Sabri can usually find the local Egyptian flour he uses, but he says it's more than twice as expensive as it was a year ago. And the imported flours he needs to make certain kinds of bread, he often can't find at all now.
Tomorrow I'll start having the rye back. Okay. Yes, because it's very much hard to find it right now.
Russia and Ukraine combined produce more than a quarter of the world's wheat exports. So when Russia invaded, prices skyrocketed. Fuel and fertilizer prices did too.
In places like the Middle East and Lebanon, Egypt, Somalia, in regions where they rely heavily on imports, it was devastating.
Jada McKenna is CEO of the global humanitarian organization Mercy Corps. She says it was particularly devastating because the war came at a time when many countries and people just didn't have the capacity to deal with another economic shock.
Even before the war in Ukraine began, the food situation was precarious for millions of people around the world after 2 years of the pandemic affecting supply chains.
If the war had been the only thing disrupting those supply chains,
maybe would have been a little bit better.
But Arif Hussein at the UN World Food Program says on top of COVID and climate change and conflicts in other regions,
it made things so difficult, not for one or two countries, but literally for dozens of countries.
In dozens of countries in the last year, he says, food prices have risen at least 15%. In some, including Egypt, they're up about 50%. And in a few, food prices have doubled.
Now, right now, we are in a very dangerous situation.
The number of people going hungry around the world has been rising steadily ever since the pandemic began, Hussein says, and has just gotten worse since the war started.
I like to say that when World Food Program sets records, it does not bode well for the world. And for the last 3 years, we have been setting records year after year.
At this point, a year into the war, global prices of food commodities, fuel, and fertilizer have come down some, but Hussein says they're still higher than they were before the pandemic.
So if you're a country and you're dealing with this, or if you're a person, you're dealing with this, your purchasing power is totally slashed.
How are you?
How's everything?
Yeah.
Very good. This is my babka.
This is the cinnamon babka.
In Cairo, Islam Sabri, the baker, says he knows he's doing a lot better than many, but everything feels hard with so much inflation.
I don't have money, savings, or anything valuable, only my hands and my bakery.
He spends a lot of time and energy these days calling vendors, trying to find flour, and often he can't get enough.
Hello. Do you have any sourdough left?
I actually sold out today.
Oh, no.
I get so many orders, but I can't make it because I don't have. And I can't find it anywhere. So I lost so many customers for that.
Sabri estimates he's lost about 20% of his income, and all of his expenses have kept rising.
I'm still very much struggling getting by here because I still have to pay rent and life expenses. Very, very hard because I also still have to face that everything got increased around me, like more than double, like very much more than double.
And it's getting harder and harder to keep up. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Use it or lose it. It's a way to keep your marbles.
Got to do that, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 108 on this Thursday, 0.3%, closed at 33,153. The NASDAQ added 83 points, about 0.7%, 11,590. The S&P 500 up 21 points, about 0.5%, 4,012. Etsy grew 2.4% today after fourth quarter revenue beat expectations. The company also issued an upbeat revenue forecast for the current quarter. eBay discounted 5.2% after posting disappointing quarterly revenue. Electric truck maker Nikola slowed 5.5% after posting worse than expected quarterly revenue. The company said it produced 133 trucks in the fourth quarter, but delivered just 20. Electric vehicle maker Lordstown Motors stalled 11.4%. Bond prices went up, thus the yield went down. The 10-year stands at 3.88%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look, payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Later this year, late August, we're going to mark the 60th anniversary of the March on Washington and the famous speech by Dr. King. The speech about the dream, yes, and equality. But if you go back and read it, really, it's a speech about how this economy back then and this is true even now, actually, about how this economy often willfully leaves Black Americans behind. The economic vision of the civil rights movement often gets lost. So we've gotten Dr. Robin D.G. Kelly on the phone. He's a professor of American history at UCLA to talk things over. Dr. Kelly, thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
A lot of the conversation, most of the conversation, I think, about the civil rights movement is about it as a political movement and as a social justice movement. Could you, in the first opening minute of this interview, give us the background of the civil rights movement as a labor and economic movement, please.
Right. Well, the civil rights movement was always an economic movement because legalized segregation was an economic system. You know, it determined wages, determined job classifications, it determined where people can live, it even determined where you can go to school. And one of the big issues that was raised was desegregation. Desegregation was intended to end practices like taking Black people's tax monies to subsidize white education. And finally, the Black community was a labor community. And it's not an accident that Southern labor unions discriminated, but Black labor organizations fought for the right to equal wages, access to housing, and fair rents, that sort of thing. Hmm.
What happened, though, at the national level to make the civil rights movement, and I don't know, you tell me, I don't know whether it was a conscious shift or something happened, but it became less economic justice and more political and social rights.
I actually don't think that the civil rights movement ever left that agenda. I think an element of it, and I could illustrate it.
Go ahead. So
if we think of the civil rights movement as extending well into the 1970s and 80s, then we have to consider the National Welfare Rights Organization as civil rights, fighting to extend welfare rights and for basic income. And we have to remember, Coretta Scott King, you know, after her husband was killed, took up the fight for full employment. Full employment was one of the most important civil rights agenda items. And they got the passage of the Humphrey Hawkins Full Employment Act. But what happened was that some of these initiatives died. They died when corporate interests and the Federal Reserve and members of both political parties agreed that the problem facing the economy was wage inflation.
Inflation, right, and, right.
Exactly. And wage inflation meant you solve it by crushing labor unrest. You solve it by reducing wages. And then it enabled companies to seek out cheaper labor outside the country. Yeah. So I don't know if I could say that the labor movement, or rather the labor agenda, completely disappeared. What did happen, though, and one of the most tragic stories, I think, in all this, is that some Black elected officials took a stand that was very opposite of what Dr. King stood for. I mean, one example, Dr. King died in Memphis fighting on behalf of sanitation workers. A decade later, Maynard Jackson, who was very close to Dr. King, was mayor of Atlanta, and he faced a sanitation worker strike. And what did he do? He broke the union. And he got the backing of the NAACP and even Dr. King's father, who ironically called the union outside agitators. And that was a foreboding of what was to come. The civil rights movement betrayed its agenda.
That's such an interesting package. The whole thing about, or passage rather, the whole thing about Coretta Scott King and Humphrey Hawkins, and the thing that we talk about on this program all the time, the Fed chair going up to do the Humphrey Hawkins testimony, and how it did all become about wage inflation. Let me ask you about something else you said, though, which is that the civil rights movement extends in the 70s and 80s. You just talked about Maynard Jackson and his role in civil rights in Atlanta and what he did in the sanitation strike there. Do you think there is a connection between the civil rights movement in this country of the 50s and 60s and what is happening now in this country?
There is. The inheritor of the economic justice agenda of civil rights, I would argue, is the Poor People's Campaign, led right now by Bishop William Barber and Reverend Liz Steele Harris. They are leading a campaign calling for, again, basic income, the restoration of welfare, and really solving the problem of poverty through the redistribution of wealth.
Let me ask it a slightly different and perhaps a more pejorative way, if you'll bear with me. So the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s in this country, and look, I've only seen it in newsreels, as have you, and I'm sure most people, it seemed to be ever present in the news. I don't think the Poor People's Campaign has that presence in the national conversation. And granted, the national conversation now is diffuse in many more ways. But I guess you're so right
about that.
And I guess does the movement now suffer from that?
Well, the reason we don't see the Poor People's Campaign is because we are saddled with an understanding of the economy that's based on growth. And that is, that wasn't the civil rights agenda. That's the antithesis of what Dr. King imagined when he said, we need a revolution in values away from profit motives and property rights. He made this speech in 1967. He says, true compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. It comes to see that the edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. That is the basic premise of the current Poor People's Campaign, which goes against the basic premise of all the economic reporting, except for your show. The economic reporting we get, is about how do we grow the economy based on the current edifice, not restoring what we used to call the social wage.
Dr. Robin D.G. Kelly is a professor of American history out at UCLA. Professor Kelly, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
You'd have thought that if ever there was going to be a moment when massive open online courses were going to take off, the pandemic would have been it. And they did at first. Companies that offered those courses reported huge spikes in enrollment as people took classes in technical drawing and philosophy and Adobe Illustrator and a zillion other things. Some of those companies were able to raise more funding. Others actually went public. Now, though, things are not so boomy. One of the companies, Udemy, says it's cutting 10% of its workforce. Another, Coursera, let go some employees last fall. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes looks at the massive online courses market.
59-year-old retired engineer Steve Meyer has taken half a dozen massive online courses.
Use it or lose it. It's a way to keep your marbles.
Meyer also wants to help others keep their marbles. He works now as a massage therapist in Silicon Valley and sees many older adults, some who have dementia. So he took an online class in neuroscience to learn about stimulating nerves. He says all the classes have been free.
Never paid.
The online platforms likely hope he eventually does take a course that costs money. In the meantime, these companies are bringing in money from corporate clients looking to upskill their workforce, says Stephen Sheldon, an analyst with the bank William Blair.
They want businesses to pay for this at scale for all of their employees.
Neuroscience classes for all, or a management course, or a ukulele class just as a morale booster. Thing is, says Sheldon, many of these businesses see a possible recession in the future, and...
One of the areas that can get cut in that environment is the learning and development budget.
And when corporate clients make cuts, that puts the squeeze on these online learning platforms and is likely why we're seeing the layoffs from Udemy and Coursera.
I think both need to show a path to not necessarily being highly profitable in the near term, but at least show that they can get to that break-even point.
One upside, online training has become integral to corporate culture. Jason Salino is an equity research analyst for KeyBank Capital Markets and says this is a big shift.
So they send you somewhere for 2 weeks and you're expected to learn it within the boundaries of a 9-to-5. And I think during the pandemic, that really accelerated the online shift.
Because employees do want to learn, and now they're used to doing it on their own terms. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today comes to us from the Food and Drug Administration, which sent out some proposed new regulations this week, the official title of which is Draft Guidance for Industry Labeling of Plant-Based Milk Alternatives and Voluntary Nutrient Statements. The upshot is that the FDA says, or wants to say, pending public comment, that it's okay for soy milk producers and oat milk producers and almond milk producers to keep calling their products milk. Consumers, the FDA says, can tell the difference between that and milk. The National Milk Producers Federation, that's cow's milk, of course, they beg to differ. All right, off we go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. It comes to us from the real estate brokerage firm Redfin, which says the American housing market in the second half of last year, to be clear, this is the total value of homes in this economy, it fell by $2.3 trillion July through December. That's almost 5%. Doesn't really mean much all by itself, so here is the promised context. That is the biggest percentage drop since the second half of 2008. We all know what was going on then. John Buckley, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Petra, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Amir Babawi is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.